Welcome, it's talkradio.nyc live in New York, and this is the Mind Behind Leadership. My name's Graham Dobbin, and one of the things, I keep on reflecting what happens on this show, and I'm really lucky that I get to speak with some really talented people, and tonight we're raising the bar significantly. Look, the last year has definitely changed perspectives and approaches in business practices and ways to do business that we probably previously dismissed or said wouldn't work are now embraced. And that's mainly through a need to change. Sometimes we need outside influences to help disrupt us, what we do, and help us look at things through a different lens. Tonight's guest, though, has a gift at doing that instinctively. Well, look, I'm assuming it's a gift because of his background. Maybe it's taken a lot of hard work. We'll find out. I'm absolutely delighted to say that tonight's guest is the Silicon Valley entrepreneur, advisor and investor, and almost forgot, the co-founder and first CEO of Netflix, Mark Randolph. Now, Mark is, although he's best known as a co-founder of the and first CEO of Netflix, his career as an entrepreneur spans more than four decades. I don't believe that because we can't be that far off the same age. And it's definitely not four decades. He's founded or co-founded half a dozen other successful startups, including most recently Looker Data Sciences, which was sold to Google for, in 2019, wait for this, $2.6 billion. He's currently mentoring a handful of other early stage companies, has advised hundreds of other entrepreneurs, and is an active seed investor in startups all over the world. He's also the author of the international best-selling memoir, That Will Never Work, The Birth of Netflix and the Amazing Life of an Idea. And if that's not enough, I don't know where he packs all this in, he's also the host of a new podcast called That Will Never Work, where he dispenses advice, encouragement, and probably more importantly, my guess, is tough love to struggling entrepreneurs. And when he finds a little bit of spare time, he goes surfing, goes mountain biking or backcountry skiing. Mark is a frequent speaker at industry events. He works extensively with young entrepreneur programs. We'll dig into that a little bit later, and sits on the boards of environmental advocacy group First 1% for the Planet and the National Outdoor Leadership School. Mark, I need to take a breath after all that. Good to see
Graham,
you.
That was really quite a mouth. That was quite a mouthful. I'm impressed.
I don't want to leave anything out. Mark, how did someone with a BA in geology end up here? Where did this start?
Yes, it is a little bit of an unusual background for an entrepreneur to have a BA in geology. But you know, in some ways, Graham, it's not out of character, because the reason I chose to major in geology was the same reason that I've done so many things in my life, because I was curious. I did it because I was interested. I did it with zero thinking that, oh, this could be a good career move for me. I mean, believe me, the last thing I wanted to be was a petroleum geologist. But I've always been an outdoors guy. I've been a climber. I've been a mountaineer. I do a lot of backcountry things. And it didn't take me long to figure out that the geology majors sure spent a lot of time on field trips. And so basically, I was, sign me up for that. But as soon as I was done with school, that was pretty much the last I focused on geology.
So what did you focus on then? What was the first move into business?
Well, you know, I joke actually that I majored at school, not in geology, but in extracurricular activities. And before you jump to a conclusion, I don't mean partying.
Be careful.
Yeah, it's a family show.
Yeah, absolutely.
I don't mean drinking and partying, but really what I spent most of my focus on in school and before was starting things, trying to solve problems, you know, basically seeing the world as an imperfect place and saying, can I do this differently? So I started magazines. I started clubs. I did things like that, which sound like they're just trivial little exercises. But what those things really are the early stages of the exact same skills that I would use many years later when I was actually doing it for a profit. And so much of my life as an entrepreneur comes from, I'm going to use the word, I guess, it comes from a compulsion. It's not like at some point in my life I said, I want to do this, I want to be rich, or I want to be famous. Because certainly back then, and yes, Graham, I have been doing this for a bit more than four decades, there was no such thing, you know, as, well, there were entrepreneurs, but it certainly wasn't glorified. There weren't movies about it. There weren't TV shows. There weren't college majors. You just wanted to solve a problem. And that has been the thread that's gone through everything. But it, which is why, you know, whenever I meet someone who says, God, I'd love to be an entrepreneur, I say, well, just start. No matter where you are in life, you don't need, it doesn't need to be a large for-profit international enterprise. You know, make something, sell something, try something, do something. Because the skills you'll pick up from doing something, even at a small scale, are the ones that you'll draw on later on as you begin to get further and further along that path.
I'm interested. What's your definition of an entrepreneur? Because you're quite right. It's almost like this new kind of phraseology and word that keeps on getting bandied out. And it seems to, in the media, etc., seems to be given this cloak on it. I'm just curious what your definition of an entrepreneur is.
I've never really tried to articulate it in words, but I'll give it a shot, which is an entrepreneur is someone who tries to do something that hasn't been done before. And I hesitate to add the phrase in a business context, because I'm not sure that someone who says, I'm going to try and be the first person to climb Mount Everest on roller skates is necessarily an entrepreneur. But there's elements to that, because really what an entrepreneur does is where other people, well, listen, I'll give you a classic example. And this is from back when I was a kid. You know, I was 6 years old, I think, and I got my first job. And I was a door-to-door salesman selling seeds, you know, for flowers and vegetables. Yep. And I am sure that this broke hundreds of child labor laws, because basically the incentive here was if you sell 18,000 packs of seeds, you earn a whistle. Or in my case, I was trying to earn a stopwatch. But what it involved was door-to-door sales. And you have to go to the door and you'd knock on the door. And half the time you'd see the little eye hole thing open and then shut again. Or if they opened the door and so as a kid, that was the end of that. Or you'd get a few words out and they go, oh, isn't that nice, and send you on your way. And I'm sure that 80% of the kids, 90% of the kids who did that gave it one day, and then pretty much they were back on the couch watching Bugs Bunny cartoons all day. But for me, it was like, I'm going to figure this out. I'm going to figure out some way to get people to open the door. And when they open the door, I'm going to figure out a way to get them to listen to me. And if they actually buy a pack of seeds, I'm going to figure out a way next time to get them to order three packs or five packs. To me, it was this challenge of trying to solve a problem. And that never stops. You see the world as an imperfect place. And rather than being frustrated and complaining, you go, I wonder if there's a better way to do that. And that is what an entrepreneur does.
Do you have any, I love the definition, and we're going to come to, I know that you say that you love to solve puzzles, so we will come to that a little bit later. Is there anybody that you looked up to as an entrepreneurial role model, even if it wasn't maybe using those words? Is there someone that you thought, wow, I would like to emulate that, or I love how they've approached it?
You know, at the early age, I would say no, because I didn't know anyone like that. If anything, I was more influenced by what I didn't want to do. You know, my father, for example, was an investment banker. He worked on Wall Street. He advised very, very wealthy people about how to invest and manage their money. But he hated it. And I saw him, you know, come home from work every day and just couldn't wait to be done with it and dreaded going back in the morning. And what he used to say, he'd go, listen, Mark, if you really want to be successful, you've got to do your own thing. And I think that rubbed off on me. Maybe not as an incentive to do it, but certainly as a message that it was permissible, that this was not something that was scary and dangerous, but in fact was something to be aspired to. And it wasn't perhaps until I really got my maybe second job out of college, where I had a job basically following a CEO of a company around all day, watching what they did, that I had the chance to actually observe what a business person did. And in this case, what an entrepreneur did, how they made decisions, how they thought about these problems. And that was a pretty profound experience.
So was there a moment then that you kind of woke up and went, right, this is it, I'm going to do my own thing? How did you go from having a job and seeing this as someone who influences to doing your own thing?
No. You know, I have three kids who are now, you know, they've finished college. They're now in the workforce. And I watched all three of them wrestle with this, what am I going to do with my life? And I certainly see their friends, and I meet young people all the time who struggle with, why don't I know what I want to do? Why haven't I found my passion? I just wanted to go, for God's sake, chill, you know, relax. You don't need to know who you want to be when you're 14 years old. If you do, I mean, how lucky is that? You know, I'm certain you probably met young people, and they go, when they're 7 years old, I want to be a veterinarian when I grow up because I love cats.
Yep.
And God, lo and behold, they end up being veterinarians. And you go, how cool is that to learn when you're seven? I didn't learn until I was 27. And in some ways, it wasn't even that I wanted to be an entrepreneur. I kind of fell into that. This job where I was basically following the CEO around, because nowadays that has a glorified description. They call that being a chief of staff. But truth be told, I was a gopher. You know, basically I'd sit there, I'd be in all of his meetings with a pad. And anytime someone promised the CEO, I'll have you those numbers by Thursday, I'd write down, make sure he gets some of the numbers by Thursday. Or if my CEO committed to something, I'd follow up with all these things. I was just trying to keep him organized, keep his day on track. But what it did, it allowed me, as I mentioned before, to see what a CEO did all day, but also it introduced me to all the different divisions of this music publishing company that he was running. And one of the divisions was a mail order division. Mm-hmm. And just like chief of staff was the glorification, so was mail order division. Because basically this part of the company consisted of a single sentence that was printed in the back of all of the music books they sold. And it simply said, for a list of more great Cherry Lane songbooks, Cherry Lane was the company, send a self-addressed stamped envelope to P.O. Box so-and-so. And for some crazy reason, I said, oh, I want that job. And I'm sure the CEO is going, this is a dream come true. You've got it. And so my job was basically taking these requests. I'd go and make a Xerox copy of the list of more great Cherry Lane songbooks, and I'd slip it in the self-addressed stamped envelope, and I'd mail it out. And when an order came in, I'd go to the warehouse, and I'd pick and pack and ship the order. And I love that. And I began experimenting. And I began saying, what happens if I do two pages of, what if I throw in this? What if I do it in color? What if I make it multi-page? How about a catalog? What if I just mail? How do I keep track of the list? Well, I need better software to track these orders. And essentially two things were happening. One is I was teaching myself direct response marketing.
Yep.
And the second thing that was happening was I was running my own business. I was recognizing the incredible excitement that came from coming to work every day and saying, oh my gosh, what am I going to try now? And especially with direct response, where you're constantly testing things and seeing how they did.
We're just about to go to a break. What we're going to do when we come back is see how you test things now, and also how you identify kind of what the puzzles are in business that you want to get involved in now? Because my guess is you're in the envious position that you can choose what you enjoy doing and what you like to get involved with. We're talking to Mark Randolph, live here on the Mind Behind Leadership on talkradio.nyc. We'll be back right after these.
You're listening to Talk Radio NYC at www.talkradio.nyc. Now broadcasting 24 hours a day.
Are you a conscious co-creator? Are you on a quest to raise your vibration and your consciousness? I'm Sam Liebowitz, your conscious consultant, and on my show, The Conscious Consultant Hour, Awakening Humanity, we will touch upon all these topics and more. Listen live at our new time on Thursdays at 12 noon Eastern Time. That's The Conscious Consultant Hour, Awakening Humanity, Thursdays, 12 noon on talkradio.nyc.
Are you interested in having a better relationship with yourself, others, and God? Greetings. I'm your host, Dr. George Andow, for the show, A Journey Through Into Awareness. On my show, we journey into the awareness that the mind of God is the true seat of our personal consciousness. We join together each Monday at 7 p.m., so tune in on Talk Radio NYC.
Did you know that nearly one in five adults in the U.S. battles mental illness? Hi, my name is Albert Dabba. I'm the host of the show Extra Innings. Extra Innings, I discuss the topics of wellness, mental health, and the experience of surviving multiple suicides within my family. Listen live every Monday at 6 p.m. Eastern to Extra Innings for discussions with sports figures, artists, mental health professionals, and many others. That's Monday at 6 p.m. Eastern on talkradio.nyc.
Hi, I'm Graham Dobbin. Join me every Thursday evening for the Mind Behind Leadership here on talkradio.nyc. We speak to people from business, sport, military and politics, all around what makes a great leader. The personal experiences of what's worked and, maybe more importantly, what hasn't worked. So, that's 7 o'clock every Thursday evening. The Mind Behind Leadership here on talkradio.nyc. Listen to real stories of real leaders.
You're listening to Talk Radio NYC. Uplift, educate, empower.
Back. You're listening to The Mind Behind Leadership. We're speaking with Mark Randolph, the first CEO and co-founder of Netflix. Mark, just while we're on the break there, I was thinking about what kind of puzzles you might like to do in business. But I'm also thinking about the name of the book and the podcast, That Will Never Work. Is that one of the things that triggers when people suggest that an idea won't work? What's behind that?
Well, certainly what's behind it is the fact that you hear it all the time whenever you're doing something that has not been done before. Mm-hmm. And the reason I called the book That Will Never Work and the podcast That Will Never Work is, of course, that is what I heard 1,000 times when I was pitching the idea for what became Netflix. You know, investors, employees, partners, you know, even my wife told me that would never work. But it, in some ways, you're right. It is this inspiration to say, well, all right, well, I'm going to have to prove that it will work. But it's not really that. It's more the realization that you're right. It won't work. Almost every idea that's pitched won't work. And I'll go out on a limb. There's no such thing as a good idea. They're all bad ideas. But that's the critical distinction here, is that if you say, it has to be a good idea. And you spend all your time trying to figure out the perfect idea, you'll never do anything. What you have to do is take the idea, say, I know it's flawed, but my job is to figure out why it's a bad idea. I've got to quickly and easily and cheaply get my idea out in the real world and find out why it doesn't work, because that is the path that leads you eventually to something that does work. So now when I hear that'll never work, I go, I just roll my eyes. And, you know, all the people who told me that would never work for Netflix, well, they were right. You know, the idea that we originally started with, but we can talk more about that in a moment.
Yeah, interesting. I was actually going to come to that, because just having a look at it, how it evolves, you seem to be a person that just allows things to evolve. You're a starter, which is obvious. But we spoke about change and about how we manage what's going on in a different environment. You seem to adapt really well to that and evolve with what you see. Is that fair?
Absolutely. In fact, it's more than just adapt and evolve to it. That is the fun thing about being an entrepreneur. The fact that things are constantly different. They're constantly changing. You know, I did have this brief stint at a large company, you know, a company which had 1,000+ employees.
Yep.
And as most large companies would have, they'd be a reorganization. And they'd announce there's going to be a reorg. And 98% of the people would be going, oh no, what's going to happen? And I would secretly be thrilled. Yeah, shake it up. Let's do things differently. Give me a different job. Put me some different department. You're right. It's exactly. I love the fact that it's never the same. You're always trying something new. And it's one of the ironies that when something works, when you finally have found the repeatable and scalable business model, well, now you're supposed to repeat it and scale it. And well, gosh, that's not quite as much fun.
So that's it. So when do you know is the time? Because that must be a really difficult decision. When you're involved with a company, it's moving, it's really shifting, but the fun goes out of it, especially somebody like you who's so creative and starts. How do you make that? That's a big decision, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a very painful one. And listen, I can speak more personally about a very specific time I had to make that decision, because I no longer work at Netflix. You know, I left quite a number of years ago, but I've been incredibly fortunate in that I figured something out early in my life. And I think it's one of the most important things that you can ever figure out as a person. And it's number one, what am I good at? And number two, what do I like doing? And I was incredibly lucky that I figured both of those things out pretty early in my life, and even luckier that both of them are the same thing, which is early stage companies. Mm-hmm. I love the challenges of launching an early company and trying to figure things out. I love coming to work and sitting around the table with really smart people solving really interesting problems. And okay, modesty alert. I'm pretty good at that. I have some natural gifts that make me suited for that environment. And so I was happy as a clam at Netflix. And we became pretty successful. We had an IPO. We had the resources. We began to hire these amazingly talented people. And 6-7 years in, it began to dawn on me that yes, I still loved Netflix. I mean, it was my baby, and I loved it the way you would love a child. But I also realized that the company was now at a size and a scale that I no longer really liked the things I was doing every day. And perhaps more importantly, I wasn't that good at it. And so it comes back to, well, right, if you're truly going to be successful, success is being able to do the things you like and you're good at. And why can't I do that? And there's no reason, which is why I ended up working, you know, over a period of a year or so, gradually began to transition myself out of the company. And now I'm back working with early stage companies, and that's my place.
What it also sounds like is, and we'll go into, we'll come to a break in a few minutes. We'll go into a little bit more about the Netflix after the break. But what I am curious about is what I've read is you've got a fairly unique take on the people that you've got around you, the teams that you build around you to create that company. Tell me more about it. I mean, what the kind of things that I'm seeing is that there were no fixed hours. There was not necessarily, you know, a fixed vacation time. People were a bit more relaxed. What is that? One, is that correct? And secondly, what do you think that does for a startup?
Well, you're completely correct. I mean, I don't know how familiar you are with the Netflix vacation policy, for example. Well, there isn't one. And maybe you're familiar, of course, with the Netflix expense policy. Well, there isn't one. And maybe you're concerned about the Netflix travel policy. Well, there isn't one. You're kind of getting the idea that there really are no policies, or there's one policy, which is use your best judgment. And actually, maybe it's probably best, but we can lead into everyone going, what is he talking about? Because after the break, I'd love to explain to people exactly why that's the case, how we got there, and actually why in some ways it's so unusual for a company the size and scale of Netflix to have basically no policies.
It's strange. I started off by the show by talking about the enforced change, the environmental change that we've got around us, which has made businesses look at things in a different way, things that were dismissed. We didn't give trust to people working from home or et cetera, et cetera. There were just so many things. And now it's a given way of doing business. I know so many that are almost, we're probably not going to go back to how it was. And some big companies.
These things, that management style, which, you know, Netflix calls freedom and responsibility, is not unusual for a startup. I mean, that's by necessity. You have 100 things to do and you have the resources for 10 things. And so there is not time for command and control. All you can really do is tell someone, you know, you see that mountain over there? Yeah. I'm going to meet you at the top in 2 weeks. And here's what you need to have done when you get there. And that's the last I'm going to see them for 2 weeks. And they may struggle. They may have overflowed rivers. They may have no trail, heavier load, but damn it, they're going to figure it out.
Yeah.
And they're going to show up. And so is this person. And so is this person. And that's a tremendously liberating thing for someone to be given that level of freedom to solve the problem as they see fit with the responsibility of following through on what they've been committed to deliver. What gets companies in trouble is that that doesn't last, and that you have a well-meaning CEO who someone's late to the top and goes, ooh, we can't have this. From now on, I need status reports every 2 days. And everyone goes, oh, status reports. Or someone gets to the top on time but overspends. And they go, oh, we can't have this. A pre-approval of all expenses over $500. And it was, ugh. And what you do is build guardrails for people who don't have the judgment to make a decision about what's appropriate to spend or what is the timing required to do something. And Netflix experiment was, can we do that for people? Can we build a company for people with good judgment?
So we're going to explore that after the break. One thing that just jumps to mind, a very senior manager in a very large global company the other week that said to me, we now KPI the high performance out of ourselves. Because there's so many, and it was just, and it was like, I don't know how we reverse this. So we're going to look at what the practical application of that, what it looked like, how that helped Netflix move on. You're listening to The Mind Behind Leadership. We're live on talkradio.nyc. My name's Graham Dobbin, and we're speaking with the author of That'll Not Work, Mark Randolph. We'll be back after these.
You're listening to Talk Radio NYC. Uplift, educate, empower.
Hey everybody, it's Tommy D, the Nonprofit Sector Connector, coming at you from my attic. Each week here on talkradio.nyc, I host a program, Philanthropy in Focus. Nonprofits impact us each and every day, and it's my focus to help them amplify their message and tell their story. Listen each week at 10 a.m. Eastern Standard Time until 11 a.m. Eastern Standard Time, right here on talkradio.nyc.
Are you a business owner? Do you want to be a business owner? Do you work with business owners? Hi, I'm Stephen Fry, your small and medium-sized business or SMB guy, and I'm the host of the new show, Always Friday. While I love to have fun on my show, we take those Friday feelings of freedom and clarity to discuss popular topics on the minds of SMBs today. Please join me and my various special guests on Friday at 11 a.m. on talkradio.nyc.
Do you run or are ready to open your own business? Hi, I'm Jeremiah Fox. I've been operating and opening small business for the last 25 years, and I'm the host of the new show, The Entrepreneurial Web. Tune in every Friday at noon Eastern Time for insights and stories on the nuances of running small business right here on Fridays at noon, talkradio.nyc.
I am Joseph Franklin McElroy, host of the new podcast, Wise Content Creates Wealth. It airs on talkradio.nyc every Friday afternoon from 1 p.m. to 2. They say content is king. Well, wise content rules the world. Every episode features tools and tips for content marketing and business people telling the wise content stories of that success. Tune in every Friday from 1 p.m. to 2 on talkradio.nyc.
You're listening to Talk Radio NYC at www.talkradio.nyc. Now broadcasting 24 hours a day.
Welcome back. It's Thursday night. It's New York. We're speaking with Mark Randolph. And just let me get a correction in there. It's called That Will Never Work. I said that will not work. And the podcast is called That Will Never Work, as well as the book. I'm co-founder and first CEO of Netflix. And you built a culture around you. So what was the reaction to building it in that way? No expense account. Kind of the measurements were what's the end result rather than necessarily how we get there?
You know, I think quite frankly, it's in some ways the secret sauce of Netflix is that people are constantly saying, how do I attract and retain the very, very best people? And especially in a high tech environment where the productivity of the top 2 or 3% of talent is not just 2 to 3% better, you know, it's double, triple. And the answer is not ridiculous things like nap pods and fireman poles and foosball tables and kombucha on tap and all the things you read about. It's fundamentally what Netflix learned is that people genuinely want a job where they're treated like an adult, mm-hmm. where they're not infantilized, mm-hmm. where they're not told what to do or given ridiculous policies and procedures. That in fact, they're given the chance to make a real difference where they have freedom paired with responsibility. And the second thing that Netflix delivers is you recognize what's important to people is who you work with, that you want to deeply respect your peers. You want to respect the person you work for. And, you know, Netflix has described itself, has said, we are not a family. Because it's not like you're ever going to fire someone in your family. We're a sports team, and we're not a little league team where everybody plays and everyone gets a trophy. This is a professional team where if you aren't the very, very best person we can find for that position, we need to find someone who is. And our obligation to the rest of the team is to do that, that you can just to use a, I mean, to use a, pardon me, American sports, since we're in NYC, is a you know, it's your obligation to the second baseman not to say, oh, the shortstop's a good guy. You know, he's been with the team a long time. Listen, okay, the ball goes through his legs a bunch, but come on, give him a break. No, my obligation to the second baseman is to put the very, very best shortstop in that position that I can so that the team can win. And Netflix thinks about it the exact same way.
It's interesting. The amount of times I have a discussion when we're talking about teams is that person's not the right person for that team. It doesn't make them a bad person. It just means that they're not right for that position. That's all.
Absolutely right. In fact, one of the things, when you're having a business which is built for people with good judgment, where you've removed all of the guardrails that frustrate high performers, you really can't have people who don't have good judgment. And it's really, difficult, but I'm going to say it's impossible to know when you hire someone how they're going to be doing in that new position, which means you're going to make mistakes. And so just as important as building this culture for high performance, you have to be willing to recognize that you may have made a mistake and you have to own up to it. But it doesn't mean you don't make the change you need to make. And similarly, circumstances change. You know, when Netflix first started streaming in 2007, they said, we need to build a streaming infrastructure. And they went and found some of the brightest, smartest people who really understood how to build streaming architecture. But not long after that, Netflix came to the realization that, you know, Amazon can do this way better than we can. They've made it a core part of their business. Let's have them do it. And so what do you say to these people who are now very highly well-compensated people building your streaming architecture? All you can say is, we're not the right place for you anymore. We can move you into a search optimization role, but it doesn't pay the same.
Yeah.
And you're not going to be happy there. Let's find you. Let's help you find a new position someplace else.
And that's the caring thing too. Let's help them find something that they enjoy and they're good at. Kind of what we spoke about earlier.
I'm going to rant about something for just a second.
Go for it.
The thing you should never do is this thing, and maybe you probably have more experience with this. It was called, a PIP, a performance improvement plan or something like that.
Yep.
But it's that usually in a larger company. And I go, Graham, things aren't working out. So what we're going to do is that we're going to write up a plan for you to improve with your benchmarks and performance objectives. And we're going to meet once a week to go over it. And oh my God, that is the Spanish Inquisition. That is cruel, unusual punishment. Because listen, I know that eventually I'm going to fire you. And you know that eventually I'm going to fire you. And everyone else we work with knows eventually I'm going to fire you. But what we're going to do now is go through 6 months of kabuki theater where you have to basically dangle on a rope. And that is the cruelest thing I can imagine. It is so much better to sit someone down and say, Graham, it's not working.
Yeah.
I know that you are feeling frustrated because you're not able to accomplish the level you can tell we need. Let's find a great place for you. And when a manager doesn't do that, there's two horrible things that happen. Either everyone in the whole department is going, this Graham guy loses, and they're looking at Mark and going, either Mark's not doing anything about it. So either Mark doesn't see it, which means he's stupid, blind, or Mark sees it but won't do anything about it, which means he's weak. And the reputation that you damage by not being willing to remove someone who's clearly not the right fit, the reputation you damage is your own.
It's really interesting because I remember when I moved to New York and I heard about performance improvement plans. But I remember the first person telling me about it. And okay, I've heard of these before, but what do they mean here? And they walked me through it and they said, that means I'm going out the door. And I was, what, really? And they explained, they knew what was about to happen. And I'm a great believer in, if there's a tough decision or a tough discussion to be had, have it as quickly as possible. Because most of the time, both parties aren't looking forward to it. There's that kind of delay and they know it's coming. Have it as quickly as possible. It doesn't mean to say we can't care. We can't do it. We can't do it in a good way. But if it's to happen, it's to happen. So we've built this culture. you've got Netflix and it's moving forward, but it's evolving from what you thought originally. So the product, the service, and everything is beginning to change.
Yeah, that's the understatement of the year. I mean, the when I was pitching this idea, the idea was video rental by mail. This was in 1997, 98. So streaming was still 9 years in the future. You want a movie? Well, we're going to mail it to you. And we're going to mail it to you on a little DVD in an envelope. And everyone said that'll never work. And yes, we spent 6 months. We built this website. We got a copy of every single DVD. We forged partnerships with DVD manufacturers for coupons in the boxes. And with great fanfare, we launched this company. And lo and behold, it didn't work. No one would rent from us. And thus began this year and a half long journey of trying to figure out some way to get video rental by mail to work. And we tried hundreds of things, if not thousands of things, testing relentlessly. And there was a process here, which, you know, at first I was this perfectionist. And so I would construct these perfect tests with custom photography and lovingly crafted copy. And it would take 2 or 3 weeks and it would fail. And we'd realize we'd wasted 2 or 3 weeks and we'd go faster, faster and faster. And pretty soon we're testing, you know, 4 things a day and there's dead links and the wrong image and we're crashing the site. And the reality is it didn't make a difference. That if it was a bad idea, that even the perfectly crafted test wasn't going to change it. But if it was a good idea, it immediately shot through. And I'm telling you this whole story because that insight transformed Netflix. It was this realization that it was not about having good ideas. It was about building this process and this system and this culture for trying as many bad ideas as we could. And through that iteration, after a year and a half, we finally stumbled on one that actually, lo and behold, worked, much to our amazement. And it was this completely crazy, counterintuitive idea that said, let's not have due dates. Let's not have late fees. Let's let everyone keep the movies as long as they want. And when they're done, just mail it back and we'll replace it with another. And we're not going to charge you each time you swap. Swap as often as you want. We'll charge you a subscription fee. And we all, wow, when we tested that, boom. I mean, it was amazing. And that marked the moment where we so transformed.
After the break, we'll talk about what that moment meant and kind of what went from that and explore just some of the more famous or infamous stories that are around that period of time. We're speaking with Mark Randolph, who is the author of That Will Never Work and also is a podcast. You're listening to The Mind Behind Leadership. We'll be right back after these.
You're listening to Talk Radio NYC. Uplift, educate, empower.
Are you a small business trying to navigate the COVID-19 related employment laws? Hello, I'm Eric Sauver, employment law business law attorney and host of the new radio show, Employment Law Today. On my show, we'll have guests to discuss the common employment law challenges business owners are facing during these trying times. Tune in on Tuesday evenings from 5 p.m. to 6 p.m. Eastern Time on talkradio.nyc.
Gateway to the Smokies. It airs on talkradio.nyc every Tuesday night from 6 p.m. to 7.
Every episode is dedicated to memorable experiences in the Great Smoky Mountains National Park and surrounding areas. This show features experts and locals who will expound upon the richness of culture, history, and adventure that awaits you in the Smokies. Tune in every Tuesday from 6 p.m. to 7 on talkradio.nyc.
Do you love or are you intrigued about New York City and its neighborhoods? I'm Jeff Goodman, host of Rediscovering New York, a weekly show that showcases New York's history and its extraordinary neighborhoods. Every Tuesday live at 7 p.m., we focus on a particular neighborhood and explore its history, its vibe, its feel, and its energy. Tune in live every Tuesday at 7 p.m. on talkradio.nyc.
You're listening to Talk Radio NYC at www.talkradio.nyc. Now broadcasting 24 hours a day.
Welcome back to the Mind Behind Leadership, talkradio.nyc. We're speaking with Mark Randolph. Mark, all of a sudden we go from this startup, we're trying things, this great idea that we've got didn't quite work, and we keep on adjusting it, to all of a sudden, quite a relatively short period of time later, the business is really moving forward. How did that feel?
It's certainly incredibly exciting. It changes the whole dynamic of the company because now you're no longer in this feverish search for the repeatable, scalable business model. Now you're trying to hold on. But I promise you really don't have much time to sit back and enjoy the ride, because with growth comes entirely new challenges. Obviously, the fundraising requirements go up dramatically. Yep. How you manage the organization changes dramatically. You're building levels in. You're constantly fighting off distractions of, now that you have the opportunities to do new things, you're having to constantly resist. Do we enter Canada? Do we do this? Do we do games? You're constantly having to say, we've got to make decisions about what not to do. So it's just a different structure. And I think in some ways, it was complicated by the fact that we had chosen, so to speak, a subscription model. Because a subscription model has some huge benefits. But one of the negatives of the subscription model is that the dynamic is that you, of course, pay to acquire the customer up front. And you pay all those prices, those costs, day one. And then the revenue that pays that back comes over 12, 18, 24 yeah. months after that, which means that when you have huge success, when you have a huge acceleration of customers coming in, what you have is an even greater acceleration of money flying out the door.
Yeah.
And that put a huge amount of pressure on the company to fundraise at a level we had not even considered before. And that was especially challenging when all of a sudden you bump into spring of the year 2000, which people like you and I remember, but I'll remind people that was the time when the dot-com bubble
yep.
popped quite aggressively, which was a terrible time for a company who's so dependent on cash to keep growing to have happen.
I've got to ask you this. It's just a really quick question. Something you said earlier about the first job and with the records. Did that influence when you were doing mail order and you were sending out the lists of records and everything? Is that where this came from? Is that one of the influences?
Absolutely. In fact, when I look back, the thing that I kicked myself the hardest about is that it took me a year and a half to try a subscription model.
Right.
I knew that business. I had founded two magazines. I knew it, circulation, subscription, inside and out. But like everybody else, I was like, subscriptions for video? And it was only when it got desperate that we decided to try it. But I wish I had done that sooner.
So let's talk about what was happening at that time and what was the standard way that we accessed videos or movies or something like that, which was a company called Blockbusters. It's interesting that the some younger listeners might not actually recognize what Blockbusters was and how big it was. I think it's really ironic that there's an excellent documentary on Netflix at the moment about the last Blockbuster. But talk me through. There's a famous story about a meeting with Blockbuster. Did that happen?
Yeah.
How did it happen? If it did.
It is the outgrowth of the dilemma we found ourselves in when all of a sudden our source of revenue is completely cut off. And we didn't know how to get out of this. And we decided at that time that we were going to do the thing that prudent entrepreneurs do called pursue strategic alternatives, which is code for we have got to sell this sucker and fast.
Yeah.
And our obvious strategic alternative was Blockbuster. And as you alluded to, they were huge. You know, they were 60,000 employees and they had 9,000 stores and they were going to do $6 billion in revenue. And so we tried to get this meeting to pitch them on buying us. Nothing. You know, it went for months without us hearing a peep. And the crazy, ironic part of the story is they finally did call, and they called when we were on a corporate retreat in a little ranch in the foothills outside of Santa Barbara, California. And I was there. All I had with me was shorts and T-shirts and flip-flops. And that's when they go, we'll see you tomorrow in Dallas. And I remember Reed and I looking at each other and going, there's no way we're going to be able to get tomorrow. And we ended up doing what you would do when you're basically about to go out of business, which is chartering a corporate jet to fly us to Dallas.
Obviously, something I do on a regular basis.
Exactly. And all of a sudden finding ourselves in this huge conference room, in this 17th store of this huge glass and steel building. And I'm there in shorts and a T-shirt. And Reed is there in a Hawaiian shirt. And I'm jealous because he has buttons. And in come the Blockbuster folks. And we pitch to them, we should combine forces that we'll run the stores. They'll run the stores. We'll run the online business. We'll do a blended model. And everyone lives happily ever after. And it was going great. Until they asked the big question, which is how much? What are we going to pay for you? And at the time, we had raised a cumulative total of $50 million. And so we have put this in the plane and decided, well, it would be a nice, elegant number to pay off all the investors in one fell swoop. So Reed leans forward and goes, $50 million? And they laugh at us. I mean, maybe not out loud, but it was pretty down the whole idea absurd that this little .com on the verge of going out of business would ask for $50 million. And I got to say, it was a terrible feeling in the plane flying home because we were so pumped. It was self-evidently the right thing to do for them. But now, not only were they not going to save us, I mean, they were going to compete with us. And I sat there thinking, you know, I know there's no easy way out. We have thought of everything. And this is one of those cases that my dad would often say, you know, sometimes, Mark, the only way out is through, that we would have to solve this problem on our own. And it required taking some pretty hard steps, but eventually we prevailed. We did manage to take down Blockbuster. The company with 9,000 stores, as you mentioned, is down to its last store. Yep. The company that Blockbuster could have bought for $50 million has a market cap of, $200 billion. It's an interesting outcome.
A story. Mark, we've only got a couple of minutes left. I'm just going to kind of, where can we catch your podcast That Will Never Work? Where's the best place? I believe you've done some on Clubhouse as well. So let us know how we can do that. Yeah,
briefly, you know, this is not an interview podcast. I mean, people do that so much better than me, yourself included. What I do is just try and do in public the thing that I've been doing for 20 years, which is mentor early stage entrepreneurs. So my podcast is essentially me meeting with real live people who are in the process of trying to turn their ideas into reality. Nice. And some fascinating things come out of it. And it is available, as you might imagine, any place you prefer to get your podcasts.
Nice. That will never work. And also the book, That Will Never Work, The Birth of Netflix and the Amazing Life of an Idea. Mark Randolph, what an incredible story. I feel that we could be chatting for another couple of hours at least. But unfortunately, we've come to the end of the show. I'd love to have you back on. I'll check you out in Clubhouse. Mark Randolph, Silicon Valley entrepreneur, investor, mentor, and the first CEO of Netflix. Thank you so much for your time this evening.
A pleasure, Graham. Thanks so much.
Okay. Take care. We'll see everyone again next Thursday, talkradio.nyc. Good night.
Radio NYC at www.talkradio.nyc. Now broadcasting 24 hours a day.
Hey everybody, it's Tommy D, the nonprofit sector connector, coming at you from my attic. Each week here on talkradio.nyc, I host a program, Philanthropy in Focus. Nonprofits impact us each and every day, and it's my focus to help them amplify their message and tell their story. Listen each week at 10 a.m. Eastern Standard Time until 11 a.m. Eastern Standard Time, right here on talkradio.nyc.
Hi, I'm Graham Dobbin. Join me every Thursday evening for The Mind Behind Leadership here on talkradio.nyc. We speak to people from business, sport, military and politics, all around what makes a great leader. The personal experiences of what's worked and, maybe more importantly, what hasn't worked. So, that's 7 o'clock every Thursday evening. The Mind Behind Leadership here on talkradio.nyc. Listen to real stories of real leaders.
Hi, I am Joseph Franklin McElroy, host of the new podcast, Wise Content Creates Wealth. It airs on talkradio.nyc every Friday afternoon from 1 p.m. to 2. They say content is king. Well, wise content rules the world. Every episode features tools and tips for content marketing and business people telling the wise content stories of that success. Tune in every Friday from 1 p.m. to 2 on talkradio.nyc.
Hey, all you listeners. Looking to boost your business? Why not advertise on Talk Radio NYC with very reasonable rates? Interested? Simply send us a message on our website, talkradio.nyc.
Do you love or are you intrigued about New York City and its neighborhoods? I'm Jeff Goodman, host of Rediscovering New York, a weekly show that showcases New York's history and its extraordinary neighborhoods. Every Tuesday live at 7 p.m., we focus on a particular neighborhood and explore its history, its vibe, its feel, and its energy. Tune in live every Tuesday at 7 p.m. on talkradio.nyc.
Franklin McElroy, host of the new podcast, Gateway to the Smokies. It airs on talkradio.nyc every Tuesday night from 6 p.m. to 7. Every episode is dedicated to memorable experiences in the Great Smoky Mountains National Park and surrounding areas. This show features experts and locals who will expound upon the richness of culture, history, and adventure that awaits you in the Smokies. Tune in every Tuesday from 6 p.m. to 7 on talkradio.nyc.
You're listening to Talk Radio NYC. Uplift, educate, empower.